This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The Pope of Trash, the Prince of Puke, the Duke of Dirty are just some of the honorifics that have been bestowed on my guest, John Waters. But in his new book, he asks, how did I become respectable? He writes, I used to be despised, but now I'm asked to give commencement addresses at prestigious colleges, attend career retrospectives at both the Film Society of Lincoln Center and the British Film Institute, and I even got a medal from the French government for furthering the arts in France. Suddenly, the worst thing that can happen to a creative person has happened to me. I am accepted, unquote. Waters is now 73, and he's given himself a new nickname, a filth elder. Waters became famous for his 1972 film Pink Flamingos, in which the characters competed for the title The Filthiest Person Alive and did many revolting things in their attempts to win. That film became a midnight movie classic. His other best-known work, which is also his most mainstream, is Hairspray. The original film, which he wrote and directed, was released in 1988. That was adapted into a Broadway musical. The Broadway musical was adapted into another film using the music from the show. NBC broadcast a live version of the musical in 2016. John Waters has a new book called Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder. John Waters, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm glad you had me back.
Always a pleasure to have you back. So you are now describing yourself as a filth elder. And you write, aging gracefully is the toughest thing for a rebel. Why is it so hard?
Well, because you can't be trying too hard to rebel as you're older. You can't have a midlife crisis. You know, I can't be an anarchist. I have three homes. I don't want to be a underground filmmaker at 73, you know? So you have to decide kind of the worst thing you can, there's many things you can ever do. The worst thing is ever to get a convertible because, believe me, old age and windswept do not go hand in hand. It's really a bad look.
Well, so much about being rebellious, you know, when you're young is about defying the older people who've created the rules, and when you're the older person yourself. Who are you defying? I mean, there's still plenty of people to defy, but plenty of rules to defy.
Well, there's plenty of rules that you can still break, but I think you have to use humor, and you can't be so angry about it. And you can't blame your parents. That's by now you should have worked it out in some way. So, but I like angry people, but I think everything I make fun of in my career has been about things that I love. I mean, in this book, I make fun of the art world. I make fun of lots of different things, fancy restaurants, but I like all those things, so I think that is the difference in tone. As you get older, you can still be angry about social issues, but you can't be bitter. Bitter and old age really is a depressing moment. And when you're 23, you can be angry, you can be a drug addict, a drunk, and you can be sexy. But at 73, it doesn't look so good.
So do you worry about things like wrinkles and how you look?
Of course. Every time, you know, whenever any magazine says, what photographer do you want to shoot you? I always just say the one that has the biggest retouch budget. I mean, you know, every time I don't want a contemporary photographer to ever take my picture. I like Diane Arbus and Nan Golden's work, but I don't want to be in it. Although Nan Golden did take the picture of me and my fake son, Bill, and the pictures came out very nice.
Oh, your doll, your kind of doll, yeah. That's your fake son.
Well, my son, he is not a doll.
That you had on your Christmas card a few years ago. And I thought,
one year
what?
I did, and people
like
believed it was real.
First.
People thought it was real and wrote me these letters about how a child was going to change my life and everything. And then they were kind of embarrassed when they realized that it was actually what they're called a reborn baby.
What does that mean?
That means that you have to order them. It took 8 months to get Bill, my son, and I asked for an angry baby with bad hair. and they make it. They put the skin on eyeballs. They put and it had a penis. I only look once because I'm not a pedophile. But I said, is it circumcised? And they said, well, it's not. And I said, well, could it be? And she said, well, I don't know. Then she called back real seriously and said the operation was a success.
Oh, God, that's hilarious.
She used clay, yeah.
So I'm going to give you some advice. If you ever worry about wrinkles on your face, and I'm not saying you should, but if you ever do, think about that your jackets are loud enough to distract attention.
Well, that's a different thing. Now, I believe that if I do have to watch ever since I quit smoking, which was 10, 15 years ago, I gained weight. So the thing is that if I gain 5 pounds, makes a big difference on me, and it goes right to my stomach. So that's why I have a weird thing over my lip and weird shoes. No one looks in the middle. It's the same thing. Yeah, and the wrinkles, you know, Ming Stoll told me, never smile in photographs. It always gives you wrinkles. And that is true.
You're right. No matter how hard you try, as you get older, you turn into a twisted version of your mom and dad. So what's your twisted version of them?
It's odd. I see pictures of myself now. I think, oh, my God, you look exactly like your father. And recently, the Baltimore Sun called me and they said, we have given you, you're to the Baltimore Business Hall of Fame. And I thought, you're kidding. My father would be so amazed at that. Both my parents lived to be 90 years old. They were proud of me at the end. But they were horrified, basically, by my career, my whole life. But they were also very supportive and made me feel safe. But I thought, isn't that weird? In a way, I did learn from my father, business, and I think in Mr. Know-It-All, I do talk about Hollywood and everything I learned about negotiation and how you get through the business and how you raise money and all that kind of thing. So I probably did learn that from my father. It was a very, very different business. He sold fire protection equipment, and then my brother took over, and now my niece runs the company. But it's the same thing. You have to be organized. You have to plan. And I have an office. I have people that work for me, so I think I did learn from him.
Did you change after they died?
Well, did I change? I don't think I've ever changed, Terry. I think I'm the same as when I first started.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, my first film was called Hag in a Black Leather Jacket, and it was about a black man and a white woman being married by a Ku Klux Klan preacher on the roof of my parents' house. And the last film I made was A Dirty Shame, which was a sexploitation movie that got an NC-17 rating. This book certainly has. The only thing I can think about my parents dying, thank God my mother doesn't have to read it. You know, that's the only thing I can think. But my parents had a happy marriage for 70 years. They both lived to be about 90. So I really had, I'm wondering why I'm kind of as nuts as I am, really, because I had a pretty good role models from them.
Well, speaking of as nuts as you are, you write that you were born 6 weeks premature. Quote, a little boy slightly miswired, already not following the rules. All I know is I was born with a screw loose. So when you wrote that you were born slightly miswired, I didn't know how literally to take that. Like if you think you're cognitively different, you know?
Well, I think right from the beginning, I didn't want to be like anybody else. And I think I was overly baptized because in the Catholic Church, they keep baptizing you. And, you know, I needed a little original sin and they wiped it all away. So I think that was the problem. I was a teacup baby that was over baptized.
But did you?
But you know, the one thing, like, there's like that great ad campaign for It's Alive. There's one thing wrong with a Waters baby. It's alive. And kind of, I think I was a little like that.
But there's a difference between not wanting to be like everybody else and being incapable of being like other people.
Well, I'm both. I couldn't, you know, okay. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't play football very well. And I am so gay that tools, even the sight of a hammer, made me cry as a child. That's the one thing I cannot do. Yeah. We had to hammer the next day in school. And I remember waking up screaming in the middle of the night of this horror that I had to hammer. And I still can't hammer. And my father would take me down and show me, it's easy. This is what you had to do. And I know he was mortified that I was that panicked. That's about the gayest thing I ever did.
Well, this fits into something else you write, which is, I realize now how hard it must have been for my parents to understand my early eccentricities. So in addition to your terror at seeing hammers, what were some of your eccentricities when you were really young?
Well, I was obsessed by car accidents, and I played car accidents. And my mother would take me to junkyards and walk around with me. And I'd think, oh, there's been a terrible one over here. Look at this. And I think, what did the junk man think? Well, what is this little ghoul? So,
what did your mother think?
I don't know. That wasn't in the Dr. Spock book of what to do if your kid is obsessed by car accidents. And my parents were very straight. And what straight used to mean was not gay or straight. Straight used to mean you didn't smoke pot or you were not following the rules in the 60s. But my parents were very, very conservative in a way. My mother was liberal later in life. But still, I don't know what they didn't know what to do, really. But they didn't freak out too much. They were confused by it. And what parent would be happy their child made pink flamingos? Really, none.
Yeah, yes.
At the time, really.
At the time, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your acknowledgments in your new book, you write, "And finally, great gratitude to my late parents, John and Patricia Waters, for giving me the foundation of good taste to rebel against." So
That's completely true.
Was that foundation? What was the good taste that they
had? Well, the foundation is, my mother would always say, my favorite thing is, "Who is that creature?" She used to say about friends that I gathered she didn't approve of. or when I would hang rockabilly males, singers like Eddie Cochran and Elvis and everything on my wall, my mother would always say, "Who is that creature?" And some of the people that came home that I would bring home, my friends, she would just be horrified. But she was polite. I remember when we made Multiple Maniacs at my parents' house and filmed the cavalcade of perversion on the front lawn, Divine came in afterwards in a bloody one-piece white woman's bathing suit carrying an axe, and my mother served us tea. As if Princess Di had come over, really.
So we were talking about your parents and your family and how differently wired you were, and how you rebelled against, like, your family's good taste.
Yeah.
So you write that you were raised to be preppy, you were sent to private school, but you yearned to meet the underclass. And you write, "I first saw real working class men when my dad took me downtown to see his new company building. My parents once took me to a bowling alley. They didn't at first realize it was also part pool hall. Here I saw juvenile delinquents for the first time, boys with their shirt collars turned up, pompadours freshly greased, girls with tight black long skirts, ballet slippers, and headscarves tied around their Deborah Padgett hairdos. How I longed to be with them." Talk more about the influence of, like, working class teen culture on you.
Well, I was so, it was the opposite of me, and I still like to be around people that are the opposites of me. I'm attracted to people that are the opposites of me. And so to go to that neighborhood and see, well, to see these kids together, they were like Elvis. They were like juvenile delinquents that I would read about all the time. We didn't have juvenile delinquents in my school, in my preppy grade school, but we did have one that lived across the street, and I made friends with a family, and really, he had a car and looked just like Crybaby. I basically based the character I wrote, Crybaby, on this person that lived across the street. And of course, my mother would say, "Who is that creature?" The same thing. But I always was kind of just amazed to see these bad, supposedly bad kids hanging out. And, you know, I went to the Elvis movies, Jerry Lee Lewis, all that stuff. So I knew about juvenile delinquency. I was always corrupted by Life magazine because we got it every week. And it always covered beatniks, drug addicts, everything that I was interested in. I would read every word of it. And then my parents got the encyclopedia, the World Book Encyclopedia, I think. And that had everything in it. I would look up everything in there that you weren't supposed to. So I was corrupted by the things that my parents brought in for educational reasons in our house, but not for the educational reasons they had in mind.
What are some of the things you looked up in the World Book Encyclopedia?
I used to look up, was it the Wolfenden Report? That was the United Kingdom's study on homosexuality. I used to look up drug addicts. I used to look up always Tennessee Williams, always beatniks, always Bohemia, Leroy Jones, as he was known at the time. Everything about trouble in the arts, I looked up.
So you loved rockabilly, you loved Elvis Presley, and you write that Elvis made you realize you're gay.
Yeah, he did. When I saw him twitching and acting like a space person, singing those first early songs, that's when I realized. And then later, I was confused by it because then I loved Clarence Frogman Henry, too. And remember he sang, I Ain't Got No Home, and he would sing like a man, and then he would sing like a girl, which seemed kind of gay. And then he started singing like a frog. But I was so young, I thought, is there trisexuality? Are people attracted to frogs? That hadn't happened to me yet, but I was open-minded to it if it was coming.
So I want to play a song that you write about, and this isn't going to be Elvis, because you write, I never wanted to be a drag queen, but if I had to lip sync, if I had to lip sync to a woman's song, even today, it wouldn't be Judy, Liza, or Cher. It would be Eileen Rogers, a nightclub singer and one-time understudy for Ethel Merman.
So, had you ever heard of her?
No, I had not.
Okay, yeah.
No, I had not, but this is what YouTube is for. So I went on, I found the record that you write about, which is called The Treasure of Your Love. Let's listen to it, and then we will talk.
Treasure I would most be longing for would be the treasure of your love. If I could have a silver ship to sail and all the pearls within the sea, oh, I would gladly give them all.
God. She was a drama queen.
Yes.
I'm trying to picture her dress. I bet she was dressed kind of like Kate Smith-ish, wouldn't you think? I don't think she was any kind of sex bomb, but she was an understudy for Ethel Merman, so think of that. She could belt it out.
So why is that the song you'd lip sync to if you did a drag?
I don't know. I just remember hearing it as a child, and I had the record, and I played it over and over. But I was obsessed by it. In my bedroom, I had a stage. My parents built me a stage, almost like Divine has in Female Trouble when the dads would say, oh, a little stage. I had a stage at the top of the steps with curtains and everything.
Wow.
And a costume box. And I would put on self-indulgent plays for my one poor aunt who would put up with it. And I can't imagine what she thought, where I would tape record all the top 10 off the radio and then perform all the numbers and stuff like a crazy person.
So you had an art retrospective, like recently, like a couple of years ago, was it?
No, it was last year.
Was it last year?
Baltimore Museum of Art, and then it went to the Wexner Center in Ohio. Yep.
Oh, okay. So the one from the Baltimore Museum of Art has a nice, like, hardcover catalog.
Of the work from
the show. And so I want to discuss a couple of pieces from the show. One of them is your, like, imaginary tabloid covers. And so one of them is called, like, National Brainiac. And the headlines are, Joan Didion hits 250 pounds. Philip Roth dates 70-year-old woman. It's about time, readers say. MFK Fisher has cellulite. Help, I've got writer's block, Joyce Carol Oates sobs. I mean, I think that's, like, hilarious, the idea of
I would love to have that magazine for real.
Yes,
and I would love it. But you'd be, we'd after you, Terry Gross, swimwear pictures. I mean, you'd be hiding outside of intellectuals' doors trying to get, they didn't have to die, you know. And I still do get the tabloids, although the Enquirer is nothing like it used to be. It used to be fun ever since it went on the Trump thing. Now it's the same pictures that are in the Globe. It's not as much fun. Except the meanest one they have every year is Who Will Die Next? And it has the celebrities on it and the odds, who's it going to be? Which must be nice when you're just in the grocery store and see yourself on the cover. But I do think a tabloid like that would be fascinating. And I could do a good one. I wish I could really do that tabloid for real.
So when did you start being interested in tabloids?
Oh, always. I think I've had a subscription to the Enquirer and the Globe for 30 years. But I still get 6 newspapers delivered every day. I used to get 100 and some magazines a month, but as you know, that is really dwindling. But I still get lots of them. I was really sad when Jet went out of business. I got that for 30 years. There was a lot of magazines that I got that I felt that I had a peek into a world that I would never know about or never be there. So I still get a lot of magazines, and but the tabloids aren't as good. I mean, the New York Post is still pretty hilarious. I mean, the cover, was it today, of the mayor running for president and had everybody looking at television laughing meanly. It was such a great New York Post cover.
Have you ever been in a tabloid?
Because what do I not admit to? What are they going to use it? What are they going to use against me?
John Waters
saw
a
romantic comedy this weekend.
All right. Well, it was wonderful to talk with you again. Thank you so much, Terry.
All right.
Until next time.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank you. John Waters' new book is called Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder.
That's exactly how I feel. That's exactly how I feel. That's exactly how I feel. I woke up this.
That's my guest, rapper and singer Lizzo, from her new album, 'Cause I Love You. It was described in Rolling Stone by Rob Sheffield as Lizzo's legend-making breakthrough album, where she finally claims her crown as a mega pop queen. Lizzo is a self-described big girl. Her backup dancers are big girls, too. Her songs are body positive, and so is her album cover photo, in which she's naked. And when she was in college, she was studying to become a classical flautist. Although rap and pop won out, she's found a place for her flute in her music. Prince was a fan, and she recorded a track for his album Plectrum Electrum with Third Eyed Girl. Let's start with a track from Lizzo's new album. This is Juice. Lizzo, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your new album. Thank you so much for coming. The album shows off your rapping and your singing, and it's so well produced. What was your vision for the album? What did you want to say lyrically and musically?
Well, I've been working on music for the last, 3 years, and I made, 3 different albums, I was telling different stories. It was different sonically. One was more pop, one was more trap, and then we made 'Cause I Love You. And I think what's different about this music is that I'm just a little bit more vulnerable than I am ever before. Even my vocal is a little bit more vulnerable. And I wanted to show vulnerability and strength on this album. And even to the album cover, being completely naked, but also looking so comfortable with myself, I think is a testament to this album showing vulnerability and strength.
And for anybody who hasn't seen the album cover, you are literally naked on it.
I am.
But you're covering your privates with other parts of your
barely.
Body.
Barely. I was actually, we had done a lot of poses that day, and that was me, because I was tooting my butt up. And then I got my back was hurting a little bit. So I just kind of relaxed and leaned forward. And then the photographer, he was like, look at me. And I looked at him, and that was the shot. So that was me just so comfortable, not trying to cover anything up. But, that's just how the magic happens.
You know, sometimes when I see somebody who's nude or who's half nude, largely nude on their album cover or in a photo, and it's a woman, and I think, like, it sometimes bothers me because I think, like, oh, are you making yourself into a sex object for men? When you're doing it on your album cover, I think it's a really bold statement, and it's a statement for women. And do you know what I mean? Because you are trying to break the mold of what beautiful is. And
yeah,
so you're
making... are you only saying that because I'm fat? You know what I'm saying? Because I feel like if I were a thin woman, maybe that wouldn't be the case. I feel like women who are smaller aren't really given the opportunity to be body positive or role models either, because we've been conditioned to believe that women are using their bodies for the male gaze. And I think if I were slimmer, I don't think people would look to me with the same type of, like, oh wow, she's so brave, she's doing this and representing everyone, that they would, you know what I'm saying, because I'm big.
I know what you're saying, and I think it's just a really complicated issue for me, because sometimes I feel, you know, like, I'm older than you are, and a lot of women in my generation fought against women having to display their bodies to sell cars, or, you know, because, like, like, scantily dressed women were always used to, like, sell things, you know,
yeah.
So, like, the woman was, like, the come-on for you to buy the car or buy the product or to sell the album or whatever, and it was just, like, selling women as, like, as sexuality, period. Like, that's what you were, your sexuality, period. And now I think things are getting really redefined, and I think, you know, you're doing it as part of, like, the redefinition and part of making, I mean, I think the statement you're making is very positive and more feminist, as opposed to, like, somebody is using my body to sell something to someone.
Yeah, but I'm just as feminist as Megan Thee Stallion, you know what I'm saying, in her album covers. I think what's happening here is that there's different waves of feminism, and it's like a generational thing, you know what I'm saying? Like, one generation asks one thing, and then that next generation is going to ask the complete opposite of it because of the lack thereof. You know what I'm saying? So where there was a wave of feminism where we were burning bras, now I'm like, my bra is in your face. You know what I'm saying? And I think that that is just a testament to human beings and how we evolved. And I think that the wave of feminism right now that's overtly sexual and in your face, I think is just the response to where we were, like, I'm going to wear a suit and I'm going to boss up on you. And you know what I'm saying? Like, you can't tell me what to do type vibes. And I was like, no, I'm going to tell you what to do. Hello.
So did you always feel body positive about yourself? Did you always feel confident? Or were there periods of your life where all of the fat shaming that happens in our culture made you uncomfortable about yourself?
Well, 10 years ago, I couldn't find a bathing suit and I couldn't find bikinis for my body size. And I was being told every day that my face was great, but my body needs work. And I was being shamed in little ways that people didn't even realize they were shaming me. It was so ingrained. And I started to shame myself and actually believed what they were saying to me. And I think about 10 years ago, I made the decision that I just wanted to be happy with my body. And I just wanted to be happy with who I am, and that I would wake up every day in the same body and it wasn't going to change. And that was the beginning of my journey with learning how to love my body. And it most certainly didn't end there, and it didn't apex there. Like, I had to work for many, many years to get to this point. Like, I think I was 21 when it started, and I don't even think I fully realized or actualized and believed what I was saying until maybe 7 years later. And I'm still working on it every day. There's days where I wake up and I'm like, oh my God, you know, this isn't me. But then I have to remind myself, this is you. It looks a little different, but it's still you. And you have to find that love for yourself deep down inside, underneath all of that questioning and ickiness.
So I want to play another song from your new album, 'Cause I Love You, and this is the title track. And I want to play this because it really shows off, like, your singing, and you really sing terrifically. And also, you were talking about bringing a vulnerability now to some of your music, and I think this is an example of that too. So Before we hear it, do you want to say anything about, you know, co-writing this or putting it together, the sound you wanted? It sounds like a power ballad to me.
Cause I Love You is one of my favorite songs I've ever been a part of. I feel like it's one of the greatest songs ever written. You know, if I didn't write it, I would say the same thing, only because I've never quite heard anything like it. Besides maybe like CeeLo, but I remember we were at lunch and I was telling the producer, who was ex-ambassadors and Sam Harris, that I was telling this guy, like, I'm not crying because I'm sad, I'm crying because I love you. And he literally looked and said, that's a song. I'm crying because I love you. Bom, 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 bom. And we were in the middle of a whole different song and I said, we need to do that. And I sat down and wrote these lyrics in 10 minutes and they made that music like that. And I feel like, you know, it's songs like that that just make you question, like, how is this even done? Where does music even come from? I'm so proud of this song and I hope you like it too.
I love it. So let's hear it. This is 'Cause I Love You from Lizzo's new album of the same name.
What the feelings, yo? Once upon a time, I was a hoe. I don't even wanna hoe no more. Got you something from the liquor store. Little bit of Lizzo and some more. Trying to open up a little more. Sorry if my heart a little slow. I thought that.
That's the title track of Lizzo's new album, 'Cause I Love You. So you play flute, and I'll just start by saying you've played flute like on TV and on videos, and a lot of people thought like, oh, it's dubbed by somebody else. She can't possibly play like that. She's not a classical person.
I don't know why people think that. That's racist.
Yes, you have some you have some very funny videos answering that. But yeah. So tell us how you started to play flute. Like, this was what, fifth or sixth grade? Did you choose the instrument? Yeah. Or did a teacher say, you get to play flute and this other person gets to play trombone?
Yeah, they chose. The flute chose me. I remember I was in band in fifth grade and we were sitting down and there was one girl, her name was Miss Johnson, and she was a flute specialist. But I really think she was like just going to college and was trying to get some extra credits. And he was like, Mr. Browden was like, who do you want in your flute class? Who do you want to play flute? And she picked me. And I don't know why she picked me. I think later on she was like, you know, you just had a good embouchure. I could tell you'd have a good flute embouchure, which is, you know, your mouth. But I don't know. And I was like grateful because I wanted to play flute. I thought it was the coolest instrument. But, you know, who could have known? All the cool girls play clarinet anyway.
Why did you think that flute was the coolest instrument?
I don't know what I thought was so cool about it, but it was cool.
So you started in, like, I forget if you said fifth or sixth grade. But then later, like in junior high or high school, you started, like, forming rap groups with friends. There seemed to be this, like, huge disconnect between your interest as a flute player and your interest in rap music. You don't hear a lot of flute in rap.
You do. You hear a lot of flute and rap, and people keep saying that to me, and I'm like, y'all, have y'all heard of J Dilla? Have y'all heard of Metro Boomin? Like, these producers use flute all the time. Like, one of the biggest hits was Mask Off, and it just had, the chorus was just a flute solo. I think we don't see rappers play flute. We hear it, and we don't subconsciously put two and two together. I think it would have been way more impactful to see Future actually playing the line on the flute to Mask Off, but he wasn't. I think that flute and hip-hop are very sexy. I think that flute and hip-hop have gone together for a long time. I think this is just the first time you actually see the artist actually playing the flute. And there wasn't a disconnect, you know, growing up in Houston and freestyle rap. rapping was very first nature to me. Like, that was what I wanted to do. That's what you had to do as a rite of passage. Like, I was very nerdy. And the fact that I knew how to freestyle on the bus or freestyle in the cafeteria and bang on the desk just gave me a little get out of being a nerd free pass. And so I did it. Like, everybody did it, you know. Houston, I think, is like the king and the queen of freestyle. Like, that's the city that freestyle really found its swag. And I'm just lucky that I was a part of that while it was happening, and also a classically trained flute player. I think it's just weird to everybody else, but it's not weird to me.
So you grew up in Detroit. What music did you grow up with?
In Detroit, I grew up with a lot of gospel music. I remember we would listen to Perfecting Praises over and over and over. That was the Marvin Winans family album, and they would always come out with family albums, and we would just listen to that. Like, it was strictly gospel. I didn't really listen to secular music or like radio music, but mind you, I was still very, very young. But it shaped who I am today on stage. Like, you get a lot of hallelujah moments from me, and that's from Detroit and growing up in the Kojic Church.
Which church?
The Church of God in Christ, which is Kojic.
So when you weren't listening to secular music, was that because of the church? Did your parents not want secular music in the house?
I mean, well, you know, it was the devil. So we didn't. My parents, so the funny thing is, you know, my sister and my brother, who are older than me, they remember different things. Like, my dad, he really loved Elton John, and my mom loved Stevie Wonder. So, you know, we would have those types of things. Hall & Oates, you know, Queen. My dad loved Queen. So, like, those things would filter in here and there. But for the most part, you know, we tried to listen to gospel music. Music makes people feel things, and it made me feel things in church that I knew that I could bring to my music. You know what I'm trying to say? So, mm-hmm. Like, for instance, there was something about the way that the what's it called? It's like a revival song or shout music. Shout music is when the drummers are going off and the bass is like doom, 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 you know, and then at that point, everybody's just running around the church and everyone's shouting. Like, that reaction, that visceral, physical reaction that you see in people that's driven by the music, like the pastor talking can make you say amen all day, but there's something about that driving music that makes you want to get out of your seat and run. And I knew that music had the power to move people physically, even emotionally, but especially physically. So I don't think it's just because we're talking about Jesus, because even in those bass lines, the bass line's not talking about Jesus. The bass line is just running and it takes you to God, or you know what I'm saying? It's just a vessel. And so I want to use my music as a vessel to get you where you need to go, to a positive place.
Okay, so I'm going to play a song that I think really gets you moving. The lyrics are very not spiritual, literally. They're more profane. and I want to play Boys.
Girl, what? This transition. All right, let's go.
It gets you moving. It gets you moving. And in terms of believing in your music, I think this succeeds.
Yeah, I will say that this song live, out of all the other songs, get the people stomping. So if you ready to stomp,
okay,
there's Boys.
And I know it's quite a segue from what we're talking about, but I see it as connected. So this is Boys, and it was released first as a single, but it's an extra on the like expanded version of your new
deluxe
album, 'Cause I Love You. The
mm-hmm.
deluxe version. Okay, so here's Lizzo.
What you say, boy? You tryna play coy like a game boy? Hit my phone, boy. Is your homeboy? Are you alone, boy? Come give me dome, boy. Got a boy with degrees, a boy in the streets, a boy on his knees, he a man in the sheets. Sheesh, it's all Greek to me. Got this boy speaking Spanish. Ay, papi. Baby, I don't need you. I just wanna freak you. I heard you a freak too. What's 2 plus 2? Three, two, hippie boys, inner city boys. I like the pretty boys with the bow tie. Get your nails did, let it blow dry. I like a big beard, I like a clean face. I don't discriminate, come and get a taste. From the playboys to the gay boys. Go and slay, boys, you my fake boys.
Baby, I don't need you.
I don't need.
I just wanna freak you.
I want it.
I heard you a freak too.
That's right.
What's 2 + 2?
So that was Boys, which is on the expanded deluxe version of Lizzo's new album, 'Cause I Love You, and it also was released last year as a single. I hear so much Prince in the production on that.
Mm.
So I know you met Prince when you were living in Minneapolis.
And, I was on his album. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you did a track on the on one of his
Plectrum Electrum.
On Plectrum Electrum, mm-hmm. with Third Eyed Girl. And so how did he find you? Because he invited you to perform for him. He asked you then to do a track for Plectrum Electrum. So I know you when you moved to Minneapolis after college, after dropping out of college, you became a kind of important part of the music scene there. But so how did he find you? How did he hear you?
Okay, so there was a documentary being made about burgeoning musicians, and also, like, you know, yeah, I think it was just burgeoning musicians actually in Minnesota, and it was on one of the, like, local news stations, and it was us, me and my best friend and my DJ Sophia Aris's group, The Feeling, who won The Voice, and Plectrum Electrum, who is Prince's band. And I think some other people too, but I can't remember. And they did a piece on us, and the day it aired, the current, the radio station in Minneapolis called, and or St. Paul in Minneapolis, they called and said, they hit us up and said, yo, you won't believe this, but Prince just sent us an email asking for y'all's contact. And we were like, what? And mind you, this was maybe 2 years after I moved to Minneapolis. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, well, give him our email. What are you waiting for? And the email just simply said, I would like for you to come to Paisley Park on Easter Sunday. And
Easter Sunday, wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. And to work on a song. And we went, and it was magical. And from then on, we had a relationship with Paisley Park and with him, where we would just, he would ask us to come perform for his parties, and we would come and perform. And we also had, he, you know, talked about me in interviews. He was like, you know, Lizzo's one to watch. She's up next. When nobody was checking for me, he was checking for, you know, young black girls and young black artists and giving us a voice, and gave me my first big check. I mean, I have a lot of respect and deep, profound relationship with one of the greatest artists of all time. So that's all I can say about that.
I just want to ask you about one more song, and it's called My Skin. And I want you to talk about the song.
My Skin is a song that I wrote, and it was, I would like to say that this was the beginning of my body positive songwriting journey. I wrote it because someone asked a question. Hold on, Jesus. They asked me, what's my favorite thing about myself? And I told them my personality. And they said, okay, but physically, what's your favorite thing about yourself? And I did not have an answer. And for the first time in my life, I had to actually think about something that I liked about myself physically. And because it was so difficult, I was moved to tears. And in that moment, I remembered that, you know, I had just fallen off a cliff.
Literally?
I was rope swinging into the river.
Yeah.
And I am just so heavy. And the rope, I fell off the rope and fell on the ground. It was really scary and traumatizing. I'll never do anything like that again. But I scraped up my skin. And I remember my friend was like, look what you did to your beautiful skin. And I still had the cane, and I had the bandages on my legs during this interview, and I looked down and I was like, oh my God, my skin. That is my favorite thing about myself. And it was in that moment where I realized I damaged my skin, where I saw the value in it. And that was the first time I'd ever discovered my body love. And I just started with my skin and moved on from there. And I wrote this song to celebrate that moment because it literally changed my life.
And it was about skin and about brown skin.
Oh, yeah. Because you know what's crazy? The thing that I like about myself the most is the thing that's weaponized against us. People with black skin, you know, we get that weaponized. And this was amid all of the, well, it's still happening to this day. But like this was the beginning of the hashtag Black Lives Matter, when there was just like such a public amount of executions of unarmed black people by police officers. And so I think that it was extremely dichotomized, and it was almost oxymoronic to be like, I love my black skin, when that was the thing that's held against me the most in the society. So I wanted to write a song about that too, and talk about how I'm proud of it no matter what. But you know, here you go. This is the song. I hope y'all like it.
Lizzo, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for your music.
Thank you.
Lizzo's new album is called Cause I Love You.
Yeah. Ooh, what's deeper than the darkest best? Kept secret beneath the surface we keep. Let it bring us together, or it could tear us apart. Oh, I'm filled with it. I gotta love with no conditions. Though it's hard to re-envision time and time again. Even when it didn't matter anymore. The most beautiful thing that you ever seen is even bigger than what we think it means. Reflections in our bloodstreams. It's even bigger than I woke up in this. I woke up in this. In my skin.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.